From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Eric Westerveld. It's Here and Now. And we want to get more reaction now to the news first reported last night by The Washington Post that Attorney General Jeff Sessions spoke with the Russian ambassador to the U.S. twice last year during the presidential campaign while he was an advisor to then-candidate Donald Trump. Senator Al Franken had asked Sessions during his confirmation hearings what he would do if there's any evidence that anyone affiliated with the Trump campaign communicated with the Russian government in the course of the campaign. Here's what Sessions said.
I have been called a surrogate at a time or two in that campaign, and I didn't have communications with the Russians, and I'm unable to comment on it.
Virginia Senator and 2016 Vice Presidential candidate Tim Kaine joins us now for more. Senator, welcome back to Here and Now.
Good to be with you. Thanks.
Senator, many of your colleagues are calling on Jeff Sessions to recuse himself, and Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi is calling on him to resign. What are you calling for Mr. Sessions to do?
Well, this is very serious. You already have the fact that the chief national security advisor to President Trump has had to resign because of lying about his contacts with the government of Russia. And now the chief law enforcement official in the United States, Jeff Sessions, has misled colleagues about his contacts with Russia. So here's what should happen. First, this makes absolutely plain that he's got to recuse himself from these investigations because he does not have the independence or objectivity to give people confidence if he stays connected with the investigation. That's step one. Step two is the Judiciary Committee should compel him to come back so that they can ask him questions about the testimony he gave, both verbal testimony and answers under oath to written questions, and they should grill him about that. If he is unwilling to do that or if his answers are not satisfactory, then at that point, Congress should ask him to resign.
White House spokesman Sarah Huckabee Sanders called this just, quote, the latest attack against the Trump administration by partisan Democrats. And she added that Sessions' testimony during his confirmation hearings is, quote, entirely consistent with what actually happened. And in a statement last night, Mr. Sessions said, quote, I never met with any Russian officials to discuss issues of the campaign. I have no idea what this allegation is about. It is false, end quote. Should Jeff Sessions have disclosed the meetings even if they had nothing to do with the campaign?
He should have, because that was the question that he was asked. And again, this is both verbal testimony, but also written questions that he had to answer, was asked about contacts with the Russian government, and gave misleading answers. Now, perhaps he has an explanation for it, and I think you owe the Attorney General of the United States the courtesy of allowing him to come back before the committee in public under oath and explain this, but the committee should require that he do it. And as far as the White House's claim that it's partisan goes, the number of Republican House and Senate members who've come out because of this, demanding that Jeff Sessions recuse himself from this, shows this is not a partisan issue. This is about the chief law enforcement official in the United States who must be honest, who must tell the truth, has now given testimony that most up here feel was misleading to the colleagues on the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Senator, you serve on the Senate Armed Services Committee, as did Mr. Sessions when he was a senator. Would it be unusual or completely typical for a senator and a member of the Armed Services Committee to meet with the Russian ambassador?
Highly unusual. So I don't know of other Armed Services Committee members who have had such meetings. I know I haven't. In the time that I've been in the Senate, I once met with a group of ambassadors, all the P5 plus one nations during the Iranian nuclear negotiations sent their ambassadors to Capitol Hill. And this was a well-attended meeting that 15 or 20 senators came to. But one-on-one meetings with the ambassador, I don't know of any other colleagues that have done that. I know I haven't.
Now, we don't know details at this point about what was said during Senator Sessions' conversations with the Russian ambassador. What do you want to know?
This is all part of this very large investigation into the connections between the Trump campaign and now the Trump administration and the Russian government. Our intelligence agencies have reached a unanimous conclusion that the Russian government decided to intrude into the American presidential election to defeat Hillary Clinton and elect Donald Trump. And it's not just about the election, because the activity of General Flynn after he became National Security Advisor involved contacts with the Russians and then lying to the vice president, possibly the FBI and others about this. So this is now not just about the campaign, it's also about the administration. The Russian government, according to the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dunford, is the adversary that the United States should most be concerned about right now. We have thousands of troops deployed right on the Russian border in nations on the eastern edge of NATO trying to help them protect themselves against Russian aggression. And so the notion that we would be deploying troops far from home in harm's way to work to help allies protect themselves against Russian aggression, but then there would be high-level contact between this administration and the Russian government that they are then misleading Congress and others about is deeply, deeply troubling. We got to get to the bottom of it.
You see it as vitally important for national security.
It is vitally important to our national security, and it's also deeply important to protect the integrity of the American electoral system going forward.
Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat from Virginia, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Well, shares of the company that owns Snapchat started trading on the New York Stock Exchange today. The Snap initial public offering is the biggest tech IPO since Alibaba went public in 2014 with an initial valuation of $24 billion. Joining us now is Queena Kim, senior editor of the Silicon Valley desk at Here and Now contributor KQED in San Francisco. Hi, Queena.
Hey.
And for people who do not use Snapchat, just remind us what it is exactly, what it does, and who the users are.
Well, I guess people will mostly know about it as the sort of disappearing photos, but they've got a lot more now. They've got these videos that you can send around to your friends that stay on for 24 hours. And they've also got magazines and newspapers like the Wall Street Journal have verticals on their site. So it's sort of expanded more. But I think most people will know it as a disappearing photo app. Lots of people think of it as just teenagers who use it. But Snapchat reported that it has 158 million users, and something like 70% of those users are between the ages of 13 and 34 years old. So it's that all-important millennial group.
I was actually sitting next to somebody who was in that group. She was probably a teenager on a train recently, and she spent over an hour sitting next to me snapping with her friends weird pictures of her face with little like kitty eyes on it and stuff like that. Is this what people are doing, or it goes beyond that?
No, I mean, I guess that's the big reason why people are really bullish on it. I don't remember the exact numbers, but a lot of the users use Snapchat for a really long time. And then it's funny you mentioned those filters, because a lot of them are sponsored by advertisers like Taco Bell. So you take a picture and you put sort of a Taco Bell filter on it. And I guess this is really popular with advertisers because it's not like just sort of passively receiving an ad. You're sort of engaging with the brand. And that's sort of like what's adding to sort of the allure of this product.
But is it worth what they say it is? Are people saying it's overvalued?
Well, that's always a question with these IPOs, right? I mean, especially with these tech companies that have a lot of growth, but they're not making a profit yet. And I'm thinking about Facebook underwent a lot of these questions. I spoke to an analyst named Dechendra Warral. He's with Bloomberg Intelligence. He thinks the bet that's being made here is on co-founder Evan Spiegel. There seems to be this feeling that he really gets millennials in a certain way and that he's going to be able to capture new technologies to keep this group engaged.
Well, tell us more about the founders, Evan Spiegel and Bobby Murphy.
Well, they met at Stanford, which is sort of seems to be the incubator for a lot of these big tech companies. And when it came time to sort of like, you know, actually have a location for this other than your dorm room, the reports are that Spiegel chose his hometown of L.A. because Spiegel didn't want to get sort of trapped in the corporate culture and sometimes a groupthink that can overcome Silicon Valley. Hmm. He hasn't followed the traditions of a lot of tech companies in many ways. Like, unlike Facebook and Google, they don't have one of these big main campuses where you can eat and do your laundry and get massages and sort of just have organic, you know, interactions. Instead, their offices are spread out all over Venice and I think even Marina Del Rey. The other thing about Spiegel is, you know, at these tech companies, they have this tradition of having, I don't know if it's weekly or whatnot, but it's an all-staff meeting where you can ask founders questions and sometimes even grill them. Spiegel doesn't have these sort of meetings. He's supposedly a very, very private person. I've read reports that sometimes people don't even know he's in the building. Hmm. And in that way, he's a little bit more Steve Jobsian. One of the reasons why they like to have their offices all spread out is so that workers are siloed and they don't know what each other are working on.
Interesting. And is there a chance that this is going to be the next Facebook, or is it more likely to be the next Twitter? And by that, I mean Twitter stock not doing so well, Facebook stock doing very well.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple things to tease out there. I guess Snap just started to seriously monetize in the last year. So there's the feeling that even with the users that it has, there's still more money to be made out of them. But the big question is a more long-term question, and that's where it gets us to Twitter, right? Twitter's been having a hard time growing its user base. There was sort of a red flag about this in Snap's prospectus. Its user growth slowed in the fourth quarter because of increased competition. That was just after the time that Facebook's Instagram started copying some of Snap's features, like their stories, which are these videos. So the question is, will they eat into that growth? And that could be a problem for Snap.
That's Queena Kim, senior editor of the Silicon Valley desk at KQED, talking with us about Snap Inc., the parent company of Snapchat. Queena, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Our next conversation might be a bit uncomfortable for some, but that's the point. A new documentary called The Last Laugh looks at the question of whether or not it's acceptable to make jokes about the Holocaust with perspectives from comedians and Holocaust survivors. It opens in New York tomorrow, and joining us is the director, Fern Perlstein. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
And also joining us is comedian Gilbert Gottfried, who appears in the film. Gilbert, welcome to Here and Now to you.
Oh, thank you.
And Fern Perlstein, let me start with you. Why did you want to make this film?
I wanted to make the film because, you know, a friend presented this idea to me many years ago in 1993. And it was just something that I really wanted to make, but I knew I couldn't make right away. And then years later, I saw Gilbert in The Aristocrats. And I said, he's making 9/11 jokes and people are laughing. People are ready for my film. So from 1993 till 2006, he truly inspired the start of it.
by talking about 9/11. Gilbert Godfrey, why did you want to be in this or be participate in this?
I had nothing else to do that day. It was something that just seemed like a good fit because I'm constantly getting in trouble for stuff I joke about. And you know, people are always, like, accusing me of, like, oh, that's, you can't joke about this topic or that topic, or it's too soon. You have to wait this amount of time, and then it makes it okay. So I was ready to talk about it.
Because you think that that's unfair, that you should be able to make those jokes?
I think it's silly that such a big uproar can happen over a joke. Like, I remember when I got in trouble with the whole tsunami business, they were writing it up as, and Gilbert Gottfried's tasteless comments and remarks, and none of them were calling them jokes. Because when you say joke, the word joke, you go, yeah, okay, he's a comedian, he makes jokes.
But tasteless comments makes it sound like it's a serious comment. It's not a joke.
Yeah. It sounds like I'm really making a statement, you know, like bad things that happen I'm in favor of.
Well, where do you come down on joking about the Holocaust?
Yeah, well, it's a funny thing. I feel the same way about that. Like, I've made jokes about the Holocaust, tsunami, 9/11. I mean, it's a funny thing. Like, I'm as hypocritical as anybody, because when there was the big uproar about Mel Gibson, they said, you know, Mel Gibson was driving drunk, and they arrested him, and he asked the policewoman if she was a Jew, and she said yes, and he said, "You Jews caused all the wars in the world." And then he called her some obscene sexual remark. And news came out that he slapped his wife while she was holding their child. And he said to his wife he wants a group of African-Americans, although he didn't use that term, to rape her. And he would hit her over the head with a shovel and bury her in the Rose Garden. And when all that was said and done, all I could think was, wait a minute. what did he say about the Jews?
Well, Fern Perlstein, you know, we hear from comedians in this documentary, but we also hear from Holocaust survivors very prominently, in particular a woman named Renee Firestone, who lost family members in the camps. At one point, she describes being examined by the infamous doctor of Auschwitz, Joseph Mengele. Let's listen to a little bit of the film.
If you survive this war, he says, you better have your tonsils removed. You have big tonsils. So, you know, at that time, I was thinking, is he insane? I mean, tomorrow I may die. I'm worried about my tonsils. But when I came back, when I survived and came back and I thought about it, what he said, it was funny.
So, you know, throughout the film, we hear details of Renee's life, and we also see her watching comedians joke about the Holocaust. What were you trying to do by telling her story as part of this film?
Well, the thing that made me want to make this film is when I found out that there was some humor in the camps, that in that darkest of dark, people could still find humor there. And I wanted that personal story. I also wanted to see it through her eyes. I know that when I, you know, in the film, you see her looking at comedians through doing their stuff on YouTube, some Holocaust jokes. And I wanted that feeling of, well, you know, it's not a black and white issue. Is it okay or not okay? Well, it depends. You know, there's time, context, who's your audience, who's the person making the joke. There's so many factors. And I know, for instance, when she's watching Sarah Silverman do stuff from Jesus's Magic, which is a show I saw in the earliest of days, you know, on a, you know, little black box theater with a lot of people my age watching it in the dark where you're not being held accountable. It was hilarious. But then when I was filming her and the camera's on her face, hearing those same lines delivered, it was uncomfortable. Yeah. It was different.
What did that tell you, that she didn't find it funny after she's been talking throughout the film about how she does want to laugh at stuff like that?
Well, that's what I'm saying, right? It's not a black and white issue. And also, she's 92. Well, at least she is now. She was probably a couple years younger then. But, you know, there's definitely a generation gap. But at the same time, just because she has a great sense of humor and a great spirit and chooses to laugh than to cry, she still may not find it funny when Sarah Silverman tells a joke about her grandmother having the tattoo from the camp say bedazzled instead of numbers. But she often says, you know, I don't think it's funny. I'm not offended.
Right, right. She's willing to let people tell those jokes. It's just she doesn't find them funny personally.
Right.
Let's listen to another clip from this film because you've got Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks talking about this. Let's listen.
Do you have a Holocaust joke? Do you have a Holocaust joke?
Gee, I don't know any Holocaust. Do you know any Holocaust jokes?
No. I can't go there. I can't. I personally, who have done a musical called The Inquisition, you know, with Jews floating around and being dunked in water and tortured, I cannot go there.
So I was surprised to hear that, Gilbert Gottfried, that Mel Brooks says that he can't go there when this is the guy who did Springtime for Hitler.
Yeah, it's very odd to hear him say that because he certainly doesn't hold back.
You know, he it's for him, it's, you know, you can joke about the perpetrators, but you can't joke about the victims. And he feels very strongly about it.
So that's the distinction for him, is he's making a joke about Hitler, not the victims.
Yeah. But, you know, even early on, I started every interview with the same set of questions. And then I'd individually research that person and add a whole bunch of personal stuff to it. But every interview I started with, do you have a Holocaust joke? Because I wanted to sort of break the ice. And I started to notice this pattern that, like, after the fifth interview, I noticed everyone would say, well, I don't have a Holocaust joke, but I do have a Nazi joke.
Interesting.
So then I would start the interviews with, well, I used to say, do you have a Nazi Holocaust joke? And then I tell them the story and I say, well, which do you have? Because it became such a thing. So I think even if people don't make as much of a distinction in that line, it's still ingrained in there. And for me, I didn't make a distinction. And when I brought that up and told that story to Gilbert in the interview, he said, yeah, because the Nazis had nothing to do with the Holocaust.
Well, they've been blamed unfairly over the years.
Right.
as was Hitler. Maybe he was a little overzealous.
Well, I want to go to something that you say in the film. When you hear the phrase tragedy plus time equals comedy, your response is, why wait?
Yeah, I never understood it. Like, I don't know where there's an office who specializes in it and looks on their computer and goes, okay, August 2nd, you'll be able to say that joke and it won't be bad taste anymore. I say jokes right when the tragedy's occurring and people say, oh, that's so bad taste. To me, it's worse taste when you're saying it at a time when you're saying, well, it's acceptable now. Like, you could do jokes about the Titanic now.
Right.
And it's like, you won't get in trouble. But it's basically so when you wait, you're saying, hey, all those people on the Titanic, they're dead. And by now, their grandkids are dead. You know, the hell with them. I'll make a joke. And that's good taste.
Yeah, yeah.
At least with me. I do it when it happens. And part of what's funny is the shock value of, oh, you're not supposed to say that. And so you're acknowledging it as a tragedy.
I remember that right after 9/11, George Carlin was supposed to have a comedy special called I Kind of Like It When a Lot of People Die.
Which oh, yes.
they ended up pulling just in time. Well, Gilbert Gottfried and Fern Perlstein of the film The Last Laugh. It's really interesting to see both comedians and Holocaust survivors talk about joking about the Holocaust. Thanks to both of you.
Oh,
thank you for having us.
And Gilbert Gottfried, I have to say, and I'm sure that of all the films you've done, this is not the one that everybody points to, but thank you for Problem Child, which had me laughing for many years and still to this day.
That was a surprise hit. No one expected that one.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by The Economist, from politics to business and finance, from science and technology to the arts. Readers are brought clear analysis of the issues that lie behind each week's global news stories. The Economist's content satisfies the globally curious with a distilled view of world affairs that is intelligent, insightful, and thought-provoking. Sign up for an introductory offer at economist.com/now.
Uber is in the midst of a few crises right now, from an embarrassing video of the CEO berating an Uber driver to claims that sexual harassment allegations weren't handled properly. But for Uber users, the rides go on. And the question remains, do services like Uber make traffic congestion better or worse? Martin DeCaro from Here and Now contributor WAMU reports.
Signs of the new mobility are easy to spot outside Washington's largest shopping center. Shoppers stand curbside looking at their smartphones, waiting for rides to circle the block and pull up in front of the DC USA Mall. Sarah Welsh Huggins prefers Uber.
Probably once to twice a week, depending on where I'm going.
She considers herself part of the shared economy.
I'm a millennial, and of all the places I've lived in so far, I've either had car share programs, I've had good public transportation, I've used my bike a lot.
Welsh Huggins, like so many newcomers to the city, does not own a car, but stand here and watch the taxis, Ubers, Lyfts, Car2Gos, and Zipcars clog the road, and you might assume the shared economy will drown D.C. in traffic. But experts say the answer is...
not that simple.
Susan Shaheen is a leading researcher on sustainable transportation at University of California, Berkeley. She's in the middle of a study on the traffic impacts from ride-hailing services in three cities, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C.
What we need to do is really understand the behaviors of the users. Have they given up a car? Have they forfeited a car purchase?
Shaheen points at private car ownership. Look at any traffic jam, and most of the cars are carrying just one person, the owner.
It's really those single occupant vehicles which represent the largest share of these commute congested periods of time.
And Shaheen has done other research that's found on-demand mobility services produce benefits.
It is actually taking on net cars off the road.
She studied Car2Go, a car-sharing app with close to 60,000 customers in the Washington, D.C. area and a fleet of 600 vehicles.
In many cases, people are selling a car and depending less on private vehicle ownership and use, or simply foregoing that planned purchase.
Uber, Lyft, and other ride-hailing competitors have tens of thousands of cars driving around the Washington area. You might think they'd add to congestion, but consider two points. One, the drivers don't need to park. District officials estimate 25 to 30% of traffic is from drivers circling blocks looking for a space. And second, Shaheen says ride-hailing vehicles have the potential to put multiple passengers in every ride. Uber says one-fourth of its trips have more than one passenger. And when those people aren't riding in Ubers, Shaheen says we need to ask about their other travel habits.
Have they started to take public transit more? Have they started to walk or cycle more?
A study by the American Public Transportation Association says the answer is yes. Uber and Lyft users in seven big cities, including Washington, are more likely to use mass transit, walk, and bike, less likely to own cars. Melvin Thomas is another newcomer to Washington in his 20s and not interested in car ownership.
I don't own a car, so Uber's a good resource for me.
Thomas says he orders Uber three or four times a week. He thinks about how his behavior is affecting the city he now calls home.
Yeah, I use the Uber Pool program, so my primary focus there is kind of sustainability, lower cost, and then the ability to share rides.
A lot of this sounds positive, but the fact is we don't have all the answers yet. The causes of congestion are varied. Just think of all the double-parked delivery trucks, cars, and taxis in any big city. And as of now, shared vehicles account for just a small fraction of the cars on the road. For Here and Now, I'm Martin DeCaro in Washington.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions says he'll recuse himself, if necessary, from overseeing an FBI investigation into any ties between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. This comes after news, first reported by The Washington Post, that Sessions met twice with Russia's ambassador, Sergei Kislyak, in the run-up to the election. That appears to contradict Sessions' confirmation hearing testimony. Sessions is facing growing calls from Democrats to resign. Meanwhile, the New York Times reports today that in the final days of the Obama administration, the White House left a trail of intelligence on Russia and the election for investigators. Joining us now is Malcolm Nance, a career intelligence officer and the author of the book The Plot to Hack America. Malcolm, welcome back.
My pleasure to be here.
Let's start with the news about Attorney General Sessions. What was your reaction when it came out that Sessions took part in these meetings with Russia's ambassador?
Well, like virtually everyone, it was a feeling of shock. There were extensive questioning of the attorney general in the run-up to his confirmation, and he made it very clear that there was no contact at any time. Now, specifically, he said with the campaign, but what I understand that we're hearing is that he may have had two contacts, one incidental at, around the Republican National Convention, and this is just... You know, he may have had the capacity to do that within his position on the Armed Services and Intelligence Committee, but why lie about it? Why cover it up?
Let's go back to the hacking of the Democratic National Committee. The first reports of Russian hackers targeting the DNC came out in May. The White House didn't formally accuse Russia until October. It looks like Attorney General Sessions met Russia's ambassador early in July when he was a senator. Isn't it reasonable to think this is normal, a U.S. senator meeting with a foreign diplomat or not?
Well, from what I understand, his peers on the Intelligence Committee, who, some of whom have been there decades, have never had contact with the senior diplomat of Russia. Now, granted, he could have had that in his capacity. But although the information, you know, on a large scale about the Russian hacks to the American public didn't actually get verified till October, it was very well known in Washington right after the hacks. The hacks occurred for a 10-month period ending in March of 2016. So the level of comfort that he was showing, it is either one of two things. It is either a question of just supreme arrogance that they could get away with anything and break the norms of contact with our adversary, or something more nefarious.
What's your take now of those two choices?
My choice is that there's something more nefarious going on. I've written an entire book about it. I wrote it in a five-week period at the exact same time that the CIA wrote their assessment for the president, and we came to the exact same conclusion. You know, I'm an intelligence officer. So I see patterns that journalists don't. and this was very clearly a massive intelligence operation, which would have taken hundreds of people in their information warfare management cell, and it was part of their strategic campaign to damage liberal democracy, which they think shouldn't exist. And they appear to have gained allies. And by gaining those allies, they manipulate and pull the puppet strings, whether those people know it or not. But by July 27th, when Donald Trump said, "Russia, if you're listening, please release Hillary Clinton's emails," it became clear that not only the campaign, but he at the top of the campaign were very aware that Russia was operating in their interest.
As I mentioned, the New York Times reports today that the Obama administration spread out information about Russia's involvement, left to trail of intelligence crumbs. Has anything like that ever happened before, to your knowledge?
To my knowledge, no. And I can't say that I'm involved in every aspect of intelligence, but this sounds to me like what we refer to as a intelligence continuity operation, where you believe that your operation is going to get compromised. At your main operations complex, you do your emergency destruct, you burn everything, but you make sure that there is a trail of information and duplicate files kept other than the master copy. To a certain extent, that's used commonly as sort of a trick in counterintelligence. And that's so that people that they suspect that are spies do not destroy classified, which would actually prove to be the evidence of that.
Malcolm, briefly, what's the key piece of information you're going to be looking out for in coming weeks?
Well, I think the information that is missing is that there will be at some point a piece of raw intelligence that will, as we like to say, fall off a truck right in front of the New York Times, which will link an individual in the Trump campaign directly to Russian intelligence, whether those individuals knew or more likely that they were unwitting assets of a massive information warfare campaign. You know, that is what has been missing in this story. And all the open source information, all the public information has been dancing around that hole. And in intelligence work, when we see a black hole like that, that becomes the target of our collection activities, because black holes in a giant story like this is where the heart of the matter lies.
Malcolm Nance is a career intelligence officer and author of The Plot to Hack America: How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election. Malcolm, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, millions of golfers around the world will likely be playing with a new set of rules by 2019. The sport's two governing bodies published a draft of the new changes yesterday. They're designed to make the game friendlier to new players and easier to understand. John Bodenhammer is a senior managing director of rules for the U.S. Golf Association. And John, won't purists resist these changes?
Well, we don't know. I think there'll be a variety of opinions, and that's why we thought having a feedback period, which will happen over the next 6 months through August 31 of 2017. The scope and magnitude of these changes is significant, and so we think it's important to listen to what golfers have to say and then consider them and finalize the rules in 2018 as on our way to implementing a new rules code in 2019.
We can't resist playing a clip from a 1944 Disney cartoon called How to Play Golf, where Goofy helps explain the sport's most well-known rule, Rule 13.
The golden rule of golf is to play the ball where it lies. The golfer is sometimes tempted to remove his ball to a slightly better position.
This is strictly forbidden. Always play the ball where it lies.
John, we assume this golden rule isn't going anywhere. What are the biggest changes proposed?
Well, that's really cute. That was pretty neat that you'd play that. I would make a comment to that. I think that one thing we did not want to do, a bedrock starting point for us, is that we wanted to maintain a couple of the core principles of the game. And one you just played, even Goofy knew it, to play the ball as it lies and to play the course as you find it. From the standpoint of some of the major changes, there are a lot. The overall theme of eliminating a lot of penalties is really probably the most significant thing to me overall, holistically looking at this. And I think what I mean by that is that currently in the rules today, a player, a golfer, is out on the course and is searching for his or her golf ball. And if they move it in that search, there's a penalty. We've eliminated that. Same in many other areas, and I think that's probably the most significant thing that all of these changes add up to.
And unlike other major sports, the new rules suggest reducing the use of video replay, correct?
Yes, that's a great point, and we think these changes will really reduce the need for the video review process. And really, I should mention that we use video simply to protect the integrity of the championship. It would be unfortunate, in our opinion, if we got to the end of a championship and we presented the trophy and the competition was closed, and then something came out later on video which would taint that outcome or taint that winner. That's really why we use video. And the video can often help players find golf balls or exonerate players from a penalty that maybe even a referee had given them, but video would let them off the hook later. So it's absolving sometimes too.
John, how much of this is a response to the sport's drop in popularity? As you know, there's been a steady fall in the number of people playing golf over the past decade.
Well, I think that that's true, but we at the USGA feel that the game is very vibrant and strong. That's another topic, but really
will these rule changes help you rebound from this fall in popularity?
I don't want to represent that these changes will bring millions of players to the game, but what I will say is that our effort with this initiative to make the rules more consistent and simple hopefully will make our game a bit more approachable. And we think that that will result in more people having fun and maybe a few more people playing the game.
John Bodenhammer is a Senior Managing Director of Rules for the United States Golf Association. John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Lawmakers in North Dakota are looking to bring an overwhelmingly disliked institution back to the state: parking meters. The state has had a ban on street parking meters for 68 years, which hasn't been much of a problem in a state with only 10 residents per square mile. But now the state Senate has approved a bill to reverse the ban, and the state House could follow. Many mayors are also in favor, including the mayor of Fargo, North Dakota, Tim Mahoney, who joins us. Mayor Mahoney, welcome.
Thank you.
And nobody likes parking meters. Why would you want to bring them back?
Because they've kept them away from us for so long. You know, they started out with a guy in North Dakota that didn't like parking meters, Howard Henry, and he made a crusade to stop parking meters in the state. So he went out and got everybody to line up for a referendum on it, and he won by 1%.
That was a long time ago.
Oh, 1948.
Yeah.
So we've come back to the legislative body numerous times and said, hey, can we have parking meters? And this time, we might get a break.
And what's the upside of parking meters? Tell me why you want parking meters.
For us, what it is, in our downtown area, Broadway is really popular. And we did a downtown study on parking and found 75% of the people park for an hour or less. And so if we can get people downtown into a shop and buy something, one of our consultants said that, you know, that's a win-win. So for us, it's managing the parking better. We'll give them first free hour anyway, so they're not going to be charged anything for that. But then after that, as you know, in the bigger cities, you know, you can use your smartphone and stay there longer if you decide to, you know, do something else in the downtown area. We have a lot of people that work in the shops that park out in front of the stores, so that doesn't move our parking people around. So that we find it as a business incentive.
So what are those people going to do, do you think, if you disturb the way that they've been able to park for so long?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. In North Dakota, people have this idea that they have to park on the block they're doing business, or if they work the same issue, they can run out and grab their car and go somewhere. And in a bigger city, as you know, most people might park one, two blocks, three blocks away. And we have plenty of parking off the main avenue that people could be able to do that.
But they can't just park their car at 8 in the morning and keep it there until they leave work at the end of the day.
That's right. And that, we think this will help us out a lot of ways because our downtown has a lot of little shops that people go in and out of. And it's just this crazy thing that people like to be able to park close to where they're doing business. We feel it's more of a need for us to circulate our parking spaces for people.
How much revenue do you think you're going to get out of this?
Revenue for us isn't really the big concern for the city of Fargo. We have other ways of doing revenue, and we would not really going to charge them that much for their parking when they do the hourly rate.
So what are the people of Fargo telling you about this? Do they like this idea or do they not like this idea?
People are always a little afraid of new ideas. So we did an online poll with a paper, and it was about 80% against versus 20% for. But a lot of people don't understand actually what we're going to do. So we'd go back to the public and say, here's what we might do. There won't be actually parking meters. It'll be all smartphone app. And it'll be gracious, first hour's free. And I think once people understand it, they'll be better prepared to go for it.
And I assume that since you're entering the parking meter world at such a modern time, you're not going to be making people put quarters in like they used to and still do in some places.
No, we'll keep away from that. I was just intrigued as at the time they were talking about collecting money in 46. It was in nickels, pennies, dimes, and occasional quarter, $7,000 for the city of Bismarck. So that was kind of interesting.
So of all the things that you as the mayor of Fargo have to deal with, how high is this on your priority list right now?
Oh, this would be kind of on the bottom half. It's not, if it happens, I'll be okay with it. If it doesn't, we'll keep living another day.
And how likely is it to happen?
I think the state will pass it. The Senate finally passed it. We've never gotten past either body, the legislative body, before. So it's passed in the Senate. We have some people that are saying, let the cities choose to what they want to do. And that's gone along pretty well. People are recognizing we should allow people to choose on their own. And then we would have a lot of public forums, debates, and discussions before we'd even institute it. But it does help if they allow us to have that conversation. And if we want to have it, we could do it.
So before we let you go, I have to ask you, as the mayor of Fargo, North Dakota, many Americans know Fargo from the movie Fargo, the great movie from the mid-90s. 20 years later, does that have an impact on the city of Fargo? Do people come and visit because they want to see the place from the movie?
We do have a visitor's bureau that does have the wood chipper there present, but we are one of the top 10 downtowns in the nation. And we're at number 3 in entrepreneurs coming into town. So we have a young age, 32 is our average age in the city. So we have a lot of young people coming to town.
And what are they doing for work?
We have a lot. Microsoft has the second largest campus in the United States here in Fargo. So we have a lot of people into software and hardware and different types of things. A lot of our stuff has worked on agriculture. Some of our stuff is working on drone technology. And then Microsoft has a big business influence on their business solutions.
And now they're going to have to deal with parking meters potentially. Mayor Tim Mahoney
of
Fargo, North Dakota, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You know, sometimes it's nice to have parking meters, Eric, because at least then there's a spot for you to take for those 2 hours.
I'm pro meter, and I'm pro wood chipper as well. Bring out the wood chipper,
Jeremy. Oh, no. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to Here and Now.